We're back from a week away from a pre-recorded episode, so we've got some news to catch up on, and also the follow-up stories to that news in 1 week. Let's start off with iOS 13 beta 5 and 6, which are both out since we last spoke to each other. We also got beta 5 and 6 of watchOS 6 and tvOS 13. We got beta 5 of macOS Catalina, but not beta 6 as of this recording. So that's interesting. The first thing I have to say is that in watchOS 6 beta, shortly after we recorded last week, or the last time together and discussed the hour tone sounds, where it was just a sort of a bell sound. There were no birds as heard at the keynote in June. In beta 5, they added the birds and they kept an option for bells, which is what I liked, but the bells are not the bells that were there before. So what I have to say about this is that I've tried the birds. They don't bother me, but they bother everyone around me. So I can't use the birds. I think they're nice. Like if it was just me, they're totally fine with me. But in my home, we had a chimney, I think it's called a chimney swift or chimney sweep bird, that its family got trapped in our chimney last year. And it's illegal to remove it on your own. And the course of action was to let the birds, the baby birds, grow up and move out on their own. And so we had a very noisy living room for, you know, the few months. And so it triggers people in my family to hear the bird sounds. It takes them back to that, which they did not enjoy.
And these are the birds supposedly recorded at Apple Park.
Yeah. The bird sounds captured at Apple Park. No birds were harmed. And it's cool that they added more settings. So there was a setting for every hour and every half hour, which I was using half hour. I liked it a lot. They added every 15 minutes, which is more than I would ever need. What I liked about this feature is that it just felt like it was, I don't need time tracking, but it was like a regular check-in on what time it is. And throughout the day, whether it's work or after work, I felt like it was kind of helping me stay on track with my goals of the day. Which is not really what it's meant to be, I guess, but, more accessibility, I suppose. But, I can't use any birds. And then the bell sound, I was happy to see the bells remained, but it's not the same bells. And the new bell sound triggers me because it sounds like the default Slack notification, at least for the hour. Like it, which I think I've changed the Slack sound from that. But, if you're used to that Slack notification sound, that's what the new hour sounds like. And, it's not the original like placeholder sound, which I thought was fine. And, these are more distinct. They sound more like sending a tweet or receiving a Slack alert. But so I've had to stop using the feature. I tried hard with the bell sound, but it's just too cringe because it's like getting a work notification. And they even use distinct sounds for like the hour and the half hour and maybe even the every quarter hour. But I'm officially out of the bird sounds now that they've arrived.
Yeah, I think we talked about this a bit before. I was always a bit anti-bird, and it just seems like something so like awkward, and that you can have these bird chirps like emanating from your wrist while you're just like walking about and stuff. I'm not surprised that it annoys people because it annoys me, and I only used it like twice. I was like, this is too, these noises, I can't deal with it. I use my watch mostly muted anyway, so yeah, the chimes aren't going to be down my alley. I think the bell alert for people that are not
sighted,
8 hours a day in Slack, they'll probably be fine with bells.
Okay.
Does it default to bells or does it default to birds?
I don't know.
I think it defaults to bells because I had to click on birds.
Okay.
So, yeah. Then if it defaulted to birds, I feel like it'd become like a social joke. Like that'd be like a meme of just, oh, I can hear the Apple Watch bird sound everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it probably defaults to off and then you turn it on and then you select what you want, but I'm not sure what the first selection is.
Yeah. I think the first one's bells.
Yeah. I think you might be right.
Be more neutral. So that makes sense.
Yeah. It just, I don't know. I know that Apple people don't use Slack much because we see whenever Apple people start to use Slack for the first time, like, it's like, oh, now we're using Slack. But surely they can make that connection of like, it sounds like the work tone. It's not good. It's triggering. The other thing is that new in beta 5, still around in beta 6, is that the iPad, the home screen, you can totally revert the major home screen redesign that was introduced in iPad OS 13 back to iOS 12 standards, where you can control the density of your app icons on the home screen instead of having it show a certain number that has the same arrangement in landscape and portrait. You can go back to the days of you know, the first iPad software where it's an uneven number depending on how you arrange it, but they're larger.
Yeah, so when it's larger, it's 4x5. And then when it's smaller, it's 6x5. So it's like 20 or 30, I think.
Mm.
And so the larger one is literally the iOS 12 design. So if you happen to be using iPad OS with larger screen, with the larger thing, you know, it's quite hard to tell the difference between iPad OS and iOS 12, as much as they like talking about the market names being distinct. You know, the home screen, and we've talked about this before, like the home screen changes aren't ginormous. It's the, you know, the same thing, the icons are small when you get a sidebar, and the sidebar's cool, but it's I like that the when the icons are bigger. I don't know, it almost seems like stupid because we talk so much about, you know, doing more of the home screen, but I don't know what it is about the iPad OS 13 home screen. The icons just seem too small, like, but I don't want to, and I toggle the setting on and off. The problem is when you go into the larger density, you lose the option for the sidebar. So you know, if it was my, like, ideal world, I'd almost want, like, the larger app icons, but still have a sidebar and just have, like, that first screen have less icons, you know, available to it. Because in reality, I'm using, you know, like, 10 apps, right, on that main home screen that I'm interested in. And so if I could take my 20 icons in half and then just still have a sidebar, I you know, I might be tempted by that. As it stands, that's not possible, so I'll probably just carry on using, you know, the more density option. And because I like having the sidebar there, it's nice to have the time bigger, and you can have a couple of widgets just sitting, you know, sitting over there. It's, yeah, you know, it's nice to have. But every time I look at those icons on the front, I'm like, no, these seem kind of small.
You know,
it's just a weird situation.
Yeah, it depends. And the funny thing isn't that Apple said we're doing a major iPad redesign this year on the home screen. It's that was what the rumor was for 2 years, and then ended up being just, this is what we wanted since the first iPad Pro came out, and it was like the least they could do. It was the correct thing to do, but not a massive overhaul as rumored. So nothing on Apple there. The I think the toggle to change it back is the correct option too, because it does make everything smaller. And so if you're used to your iPad looking one way, updating and everything getting smaller is not a good scenario. So having the option set up to say, do you want this view or this view, just like you have options for like the scaled view and the default view, is good when possible. But for me,
it's very similar to like iPhone display zoom, right?
But right. Yeah. And for me, I will totally continue using the denser option because, I like all the benefits of you can rotate your screen and your icons don't move their placement. They just change in place, and you can do the sidebar. And when I recently moved back to the 12.9 inch iPad Pro, it wasn't running in the beta, of course, because it was purchased, you know, before iOS 13 is released. So I had to set it up as an iOS 12 iPad and then update it to iOS 13 before I could restore to that. And so I got a glimpse again of the default icon size on the big screen, and going from the 11 inch iPad Pro with the dense icon view to the big iPad Pro with big app icons, it was just comical. So,
yeah.
I think unless it's like for vision reasons, I think the dense view is the one to go with, because they haven't they didn't make it where, you know, you can have big icons and a sidebar, just have fewer icons, and the icons are in an arrangement that where they don't move their place whenever you rotate your screen. If they did that, then I'd say, yeah, just pick your preference. But
yeah,
like you said, because it's just reverting to the old option. Yeah, and it
definitely feels more like accessibility minded rather than, or maybe like kids minded, that they don't care about these widgets and stuff. They just want to have a big, you know, here's their games. They can just tap on them and be done with it.
Yeah,
kids are a big like iPad market.
Yeah, on my kids' iPad Mini, I found that the dense icon view is kind of neat because I can put a lot of apps on page one have no page zero, and then on the widget side have that always in focus, but then only use like the TV app widget. And so it's just like a list of movies and TV shows serviced on their home screen versus like, you know, you've got to go to the TV app and see that, which I like more. But yeah, it's an option. There's also changes
And they let you pin, because in the first beta, you can only pin two. And then I think it was five. They now like upped it, so you can pin like three or four widgets, so they're always visible. Whereas before, you'd only get two, so it kind of felt, especially in the 12.9, it's just like, you know, you've got some more space to use it. But now they actually let you pin more than two, so it's quite, you know, it actually feels more functional.
Right, and the share sheet has changed on iOS 13 as of beta 5, and that change sticks in beta 6. Describe what happens here, because the new share sheet is a big feature of iOS 13, but now it's not exactly the way it was laid out in beta 1 through 4. So what's different there?
Yeah, so the kind of top rows are basically the same. They're the ones that have the friends shortcuts, which in all the betas at the moment just only has messages, but apps can integrate with that as well. So you could have like WhatsApp direct sharing for contacts there as well. That's where the AirDrop thing appears for your own devices. And then you have the second row, which is other apps to share to. That's where like Twitter and Facebook turn up when you're sharing, you know, like email links or text or websites and stuff. And then below that is the kind of actions area. And that's the primary thing that's changed here for the better, because originally it was kind of messy, and then they just had like all of the actions in one big list, and there was no separation or kind of organization or hierarchy at all. Now they've you know, made it a bit more sophisticated, where it basically has three sections. And so you have favorites, actions specific to the app that you're in, and then all the rest. So like for contributions from third-party extensions and stuff. And you can choose to edit your actions, and you can pick favorites on a per app basis. So they're always appearing in that top group. And then you have like the app specific actions in the middle, and then all of the rest ones at the bottom, which is also where like shortcuts and stuff appear now. So the kind of actions that like would be specific to the current operation are always in that middle section. And then you have just all of the kind of like other sharing actions that don't fit in that, you know, the app icon rows go down at the bottom. So you get a bit more hierarchy, and it's not all just like jumbled together. It's still not perfect, because like on my phone still, you have the problem where when you first show the share sheet, it only opens with half of the, like lifting up half of the screen. So it's like a modal, which doesn't go all the way to the top of the screen. And still on iPhone 10 size phones, that means you can only see one action without swiping up, which seems a bit stupid. Like on the old system, where it would be a horizontally scrolling thing, you could see like five actions, right? And now you only see one, maybe two, without having to scroll, and then you scroll through it. I also kind of wish that the icons for the actions were next to the labels. So it was like icon text, right? Whereas at the moment it's text, and then the icons are like right aligned on the other side. So your eyes kind of have to like dart back and forward to just see everything. But it's definitely better than what it was. And predominantly, I think for like the average user, like not us, right? But like normal people, they're going to be like satisfied just by the top two rows anyway. So the kind of actions layout stuff doesn't matter as much, because I think what most people do with that share sheet is they just send stuff to their friends, whether that's Facebook, Twitter, messages, and all of that stuff is still accommodated very well by those top two rows. So the action stuff is good, especially if you have a lot of shortcuts, because they would like fill up that thing ridiculously. I think they could still be better. Like having just one button per row is kind of wasteful, but it is you know, miles better than what it was in beta one at least. So. And maybe they'll, you know, continue to refine it. Probably too late now for iOS 13.0, but, you know, 0.1, 0.2, something like that. They could still do some, you know, more follow-up to it.
Yeah. Have you seen the new option in beta 6 where whenever you 3D touch or haptic touch on a link, like a web page, the old behavior, of course, was peek and pop. And you could, you know, you see like a pop-up of the window preview, and then you could move that for some actions. And now it's a list of actions with the pop-up above that. Now there's this new show link previews or hide link previews option, or that instead of having the window load in place in that view, it can just be the web link.
It just shows the URL, yeah.
Yeah.
I think having the option's nice, but why is it in the same menu as like the share actions?
Yeah, maybe it should be in the settings instead. I don't know. I mean, it's nice that you can change it in the view. But I tried using this, and I think I like it because I think the web preview is often so limited that it's just more taxing to have it load in than not load in, and there's less benefit from it for me. But the problem so far is that it's per app that you hit that setting. So if every link in every app every app you've got to say hide links so far. So yeah, a universal setting would be nice. And then also like if a setting probably should be just hide ones. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about having the rearrange icons option in that list too on the home screen. It's like, it can get in the way sometimes, and that's the kind of thing that you'd want to have somewhere else. But
yeah, like the rearrange apps action should be in like, it's good to be on that screen because if people, trying to jiggle but they don't get there, but that button should be like in the corner of the screen, not in that main list. Right? Like, sure, it should be in that group. It should be in like the bottom left corner or something. And that's where I kind of feel like the link previews option should be as well. Like separated from, the primary actions. Like it's almost, it's like a setting for the preview screen. It doesn't make sense for it to be in like the share area, right? And also for the link preview stuff, could they not kind of just do like the best of both worlds and have no setting at all and just have like the URL like sit on top of the preview anyway? Like, is there a reason why they can't just have the URL at visible next to the preview, kind of like a mini like Safari address bar type thing? Like, I don't really get why they're so opposed to doing something like that.
Yeah. And another thing is on the home screen, whenever you do 3D touch to get those actions, they've gotten much closer to the old way where you can 3D touch and then swipe up in like one motion. So they're listening and they're getting closer to what they're, what they're removing. It's not quite the same, but it's pretty close. But like, for example, I've got Twitter on my home screen and it's one of the lower on the screen apps. And so the first action is to share Twitter, like the app, which I know that you hate that option. I've used it a few times, but, it's a way to copy the link or message it to somebody from without going to the app store. And then there's rearrange apps and then there's the action. So capture new message, tweet and search. So in that case, you've got to kind of go past the junk, and there's like a tiny divider between the actions and then the built-in stuff. So that's getting populated. And, so that's something they'll have to watch for, is not to abuse that too much, because it's already getting kind of junky, from the promise of just quick actions to now more stuff. Also, this is something you wanted, was a dark mode toggle in Control Center, not just from the brightness settings, but right in Control Center.
Yep. And in beta 5, they added a dark appearance toggle to the accessibility shortcut options. So that's the thing. Accessibility shortcut is where you can set up something to happen when you triple click the side button.
Oh.
And it's obviously meant as a, it's meant for people that have limited movement and stuff. So you can put all sorts of things on it. Like that's the kind of thing where people have invert colors if you want to toggle it on and off and stuff like that. And so in beta 5, you could activate dark appearance by triple clicking the power button. In beta 6, they removed the accessibility shortcut and have added instead the dark toggle directly to Control Center. I don't really know why they got rid of it as the accessibility shortcut, because it's kind of useful, especially if like a developer, if you just want to quickly toggle between the different themes.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I originally wanted was the Control Center button, and they have added that now. So before, you'd have to like press on the brightness, then you click on it down there. If you toggle dark mode more than a couple of times a day, and when I'm doing development and stuff, or I'm just testing apps out, I toggle that thing quite a lot. It gets annoying to have to like swipe down, press in, click it. Having it directly on that first screen is a nice touch, and it's not one by default, but you can just, you go into settings, you customize controls, you can add it in, and then you just tap it and it turns dark mode on, you tap it, turns dark mode off. Funnily enough, they've kind of like de-emphasized the whole light versus dark mode thing in that view, because now whether you're going from the button or from pressing in, what it says is dark mode off, dark mode on. Whereas it used to say dark mode it used to say dark appearance, light appearance. Mm-hmm. And now it just says dark appearance on, dark appearance off. So it's almost like, it's kind of a weird verbiage to use, because, you know, you, you are in light mode technically, really, but they just kind of, they almost have it as this toggle of is dark on or not. It's kind of a weird way they phrased that, which is interesting.
The only thing I can think for that is that some apps have a dark theme and they don't react to light mode because they've always had a dark theme, like Activity, for example, in the Watch app, and they don't go light mode whenever you're in light mode. So it kind of is more true to that, but it's different. It's weird.
Yeah, and if you look in the actual system settings and you find the appearance option there, they still call it light and dark.
So right.
I don't know what they're doing there, but the functionality works. So they've answered one of my feature requests, at least. Today's episode of Happy Hour is brought to you by Home IQ. Introducing the new Only Brush. Only Brush is an iOS-controlled smart toothbrush and travel kit launching this week. For 95 Mac's deal of the month, you can pre-order the new Only Brush travel kit for $60. At $60, that's 60% off its normal price. The Only Brush can be controlled by an iPhone or Apple Watch. It is a complete teeth-cleaning travel kit with a specially designed electric toothbrush that is part of its own carrying case. There's also built-in toothpaste and dental floss dispensers, an integrated 2-minute timer, and even a mini mirror. The toothbrush has 3 vibration modes for gentle brushing, daily cleaning, and whitening. And it uses sonic wave technology to clean your teeth more quietly and to be gentler on your gums, making it a safer choice for seniors and children alike. This is all contained in a sleek white case. The toothbrush charges wirelessly with Qi or wired with the included USB-C cable. Only Brush is the only electric toothbrush in the world that charges over Qi, so you can use the same charging mat that you charge your iPhone with. With a companion app on iPhone or Apple Watch, you can change brush modes, set a brushing time schedule, and much more. And the product is environmentally conscious too, using sustainable, eco-friendly materials. Get 60% off the new Only Brush iOS-controlled smart toothbrush and travel kit. Check out the link in the show notes to find more information. Thanks again to Home IQ for sponsoring the show.
I prefer dark mode most of the time, unless I'm in an environment where it's just so hard to see the screen in dark mode, like being in really bright sunlight in the summer. And, I've tried doing things like change it automatically based on sunset and sunrise versus like the time of day. And that's useful. And they've added a behavior to that, which is before it would do it. I think just like if it knows the sunrise times, so it would just trigger it at that time, even if you're using the phone. And I think to make it, smoother, they've made the behavior that sometimes it might change. It might not change when sunrise hits, but the next time that you turn your screen on, so you don't see it transition. It transitions when you're not using it.
Yeah, they like defer it slightly, so it's not switching whilst you were like in the middle of typing something on the keyboard.
Not as jarring. But that doesn't really work for me because I still want to use dark mode most of the time. Like when I'm indoors, I just prefer the way dark mode looks. And also there are so many apps that, when iOS 13 comes out, they'll adopt the new dark mode behavior. But so far I'm using Twitter and Things and Messenger and Apollo for Reddit in dark mode, but they have their own app dark modes for iOS 12 and earlier, and they don't use the new stuff yet because they're not iOS 13 apps. So even if I automate dark mode on and off based on sunset and sunrise, then those apps don't, I have to use their automation settings too if they have them. And really what I'm looking for is if the screen brightness is max, I want light mode because it's max for a reason. And then otherwise use dark mode, which is what some apps have pulled off. Like I think Tweetbot has done that.
Yeah, that's how Tweetbot works.
Yeah, they do that where you set the level of brightness to what you want it to trigger. And iOS doesn't do that yet, but it would be cool. So what I do is I just use dark mode all the time, and then I change it from the brightness toggle in Control Center. And the fact that when you add the new toggle as one of the tile options, you still have it in the brightness section. Mm-hmm. I've not yet added it because I feel like it's in two places that are too close and I'm not changing it enough to make it worth it. The triple click thing though, that's interesting because I do like to use triple click for actions that I don't do very often, but do enough. Like I think I usually have that set to guided access so that if my kid is watching a video on the iPad and they want to watch the video and not, you know, invoke Siri or accidentally close the app and get frustrated, they just want it as a video player, guided access is awesome for that because you can disable certain things like touch, motion, you know, volume, power. So that I use it for that to go on and off easily. Once recently, like at the beginning of the summer, I think I had assigned the option where you make it darker than default, like you lower the white point of your phone.
Yeah, it kind of like software dims it as well as like the hardware screen brightness.
Yeah, so I did that. I guess I forgot that I had assigned that to a triple click, and for a few weeks I thought I was just losing my sight. And then it's summertime, it's brighter outside, I've got bad vision already, and I just guess it's just getting worse, or my iPhone is like, you know, wearing out sooner. And then one day I triple clicked just on a whim and it brightened up, and I was like so happy because I was gonna have try to have it serviced and get new glasses and things. Like,
that's funny.
Yeah, it was just that I told you when that happened. I was so relieved. But also, in beta 5 and 6, there's now a new CarPlay option to turn off the album art that was added around beta 3 or 4 to the now playing screen for music and podcasts and audiobooks. And the thing this addresses is that album art has always been visible, but it's been like masked behind some blur with text over it. So you don't really.
Yeah, it was just like the background of decoration.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to see. Like, it's not legible. So they added true album art over that, and it's right aligned, and then the text is like on, is like left. The problem is that that's ideal for those wide screens in like 1% of CarPlay cars, but for everyone else, it cramps in the space for the artist name and album and track name. And so in beta 5, they address this by adding the hide album art option. So you can turn it off if you want to. But it was kind of punitive because they made the text super small then. Like, it was almost illegible at a glance, even if you had album art off. And so they were trying to address the truncation problem where so much text can't fit there if it's like a long string of an album name or something. So they just made it really small. But it was like even smaller with album art off than on, which didn't make a lot of sense. In beta 6, they kind of addressed the text size thing, and then album art is still an option there. But they've not done what I think probably needs to happen, even though it's a car, which is to make the text scrollable, you know, just have it move left to right. You know, at least on like the first instance of the text appearing, because there's still a lot of truncation, even if you have album art off. And I really dislike text truncation, especially when there's a lot of open space on the screen for that text could go and flow.
Yeah. And the scrolling marquee's like not distracting or anything. It's just, I see loads of like standard car, you know, non-CarPlay cars, just, you know, normal in software car UIs. They do like the kind of left to right scrolling to show mm-hmm. full track names and stuff, because you know you actually want to read it and you don't want to be stuck just looking at five words and three dots. So,
and
obviously the music app on iOS does that exactly.
My carrier name does that on iOS when I use Wi-Fi calling AT&T WIF. So yeah, it's not beneath Apple, and it's definitely allowed on the road because, like you said, a lot of cars do it already by default, and that's all anyone wants is for all the text to be visible at some point. So
yeah, and obviously beta 6 was 1 week after beta 5, so we're definitely on that kind of end of the train now where it's kind of just like weekly stability stuff, and then you're probably not going to introduce anything super radical anymore.
Yeah, I think in iOS 12 we saw 11 betas total, and part of that is that, you know, we're both like in the halfway point, but it's a little bit different than in saying halfway, because you do go from every 2 weeks or so to every week you see some changes. And then even sometimes you'll get like two betas in 1 week. So even though we're kind of over halfway now, you might look at it more as like 75% of the way there, just based on how these things go. There's been a lot of talk from people though about like the fear of these betas being so bad and buggy that they might not ship with new iPhones in the fall in September, that Apple might be forced to ship like iOS 12.5 on iPhone 11s. I think we both feel strongly about that not being possible even.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Like, the iPhone 11 firmware's a built up across the year, and the camera system, the A13 chip, all of that stuff is so tightly coded against like the iOS 13 platform, as it were, that, you know, if you are in a situation where they think iOS 13 is too buggy, one of the options they do not have is, oh, just make the iPhone 11 run on 12.4 or whatever, because that stuff will take forever. And it'd be such a backward step anyway, because, you know, you want to make people move on to 13 a month later anyway. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a waste of resources and it's just unfeasible. Like, that stuff probably takes months to shake out and fix. And then you have to bug test. You probably cause more bugs backporting it than you would, you know, just carrying on down the train. Like, the options they have are release the phones later, which they're unlikely to do for, you know, financial reasons, realistically, and sure, all of that stuff. So, you know, they have the whole hardware schedule on a separate track anyway. What they're going to do, obviously, is ship the phones with the software that's ready, and the software has to be finalized for devices at, like, the start of September. You know, even if the betas come out later, they then have to get rolled forward into, like, a 0.0.1. But that's what, you know, this is the same old rodeo. It's nothing new. You know, take out iOS 12, you look at 11, 10, all that stuff. It's very similar. They ship what's ready. It comes out. There's a day one patch where they do some bug fixes. They follow up with some more bug fixes. And then in October, there's the 0.1, which, you know, generally would fix, you know, any of the outstanding issues. Like, I think people are getting fretting about this primarily because they're always contrasting it to the iOS 12 beta cycle, which was, you know, unusually good and stable. I think if you look at iOS 13 beta 6, it's about the same as any normal beta release, really, and it could, you know, stabilize fully by the end of the month, basically. Like, I don't think it's any danger situation of stuff being super bad. There are a few rough edges, but I don't think it's anything out of the ordinary. Something that Apple's not opposed to doing as well is, you know, releasing the 0.0, but without some of the features that they announced at WWDC. And as it stands in beta 6, they have actually taken some stuff out. Now, they haven't said yet if it's going to return in time for the release or if it will be pushed to like 0.1 or something. But on beta 6, shortcuts automations are no longer available. They showed up in the home app as well. They're not there either. You have iCloud Photos. Can I just start again?
Yeah.
I'll just start from the beginning.
I'm going to say 32 minutes is when we pick that up. Yep.
iCloud. Okay. Yeah, and when you're faced with like potential software instabilities and bugs and stuff, one thing that Apple's also not opposed to doing is just releasing the major releases 0.0, but then pulling out features that aren't quite baked and aren't quite done and releasing them later in like 0.1 and stuff. And as of beta 6, you know, they have sort of done that. They haven't said that these things are not going to be ready for the release yet, and there's, you know, maybe some indications that they'll be coming back, but as it stands, shortcuts automations are not there, home automations are not there, the iCloud folder sharing options have gone temporarily, it seems, and Share ETA, which is one of the cool features of the Apple Maps update for this year that we talked about before, is also, the settings for those have also vanished in this latest beta. So there's definitely some turbulence about exactly what the software offering is going to be on the 0.0. Obviously, maybe, and they're kind of running out of time for that stuff to come back. Like, now we're on the weekly releases. That tends to be when they lock down, like, feature, you know, go feature complete, essentially, and just sit there. But there was, like, a Twitter employee. They were on Twitter. There was a software engineer on the Shortcuts team who said, oh, we've had to take out the automation stuff, but it's coming back. So maybe, you know, maybe the schedule is back on track and they just had to take it out for some, you know, wonky reason. I do really like the Shortcuts stuff, though, and it's kind of annoying that the automations are gone because I was actually using them. Like, we haven't really talked about it so far on the show, but Shortcuts on iOS 13 have actually got quite a lot of changes in, for start, the app's built in now, and they've kind of got rid of the mess of where before you'd have the Shortcuts app, which obviously you'd have to download from the App Store on iOS 12, and then you'd have the Shortcuts settings in like the Siri and Shortcuts panes in the settings app, and you'd have stuff there where it'd be like the management center for your recorded shortcuts from other apps, but then you'd have to, if you wanted to make like workflow type shortcuts in multiple actions, you have to do it in the Shortcuts app. On 13, now that the app's built in, they've also moved all of that kind of like management and diagnostics into the Shortcuts app only. So that's like the place where you go to do everything, and they've, you know, they're unifying the experience in a positive step. Also the kind of weird thing where you'd have like the shortcut name, but then you could also record a voice phrase separately. They've kind of flattened that as well. So now you name the shortcut what you want to say to Siri to activate it. So it's again reducing that kind of friction. And they've even just the way that you like build up the shortcuts have changed, because before it was more, they've made it more human, and like each of the actions are now more natural language and the parameters are kind of in the sentence. So whereas before it'd be like get photos, and then below get photos, it would have like a list of options and you'd like tap through and set the preferences for each one and the filters. Now it'll be like get photos from location between these dates. And those fields, like location and dates, are like tappable, interactable, so you can fill them out basically. And then you just kind of read a sentence, and that's the action with the data encoded. And so they're, you know, they're trying to make it more human and easy to understand. And that feeds into the like SDK improvements that they've done, where they're now allowing third-party shortcuts to include stuff like variables and inputs and outputs. And so before on iOS 12. That was essentially impossible, because the third-party like Siri shortcuts would only be able to trigger or show UI, basically. You wouldn't be able to pass along data from that shortcut further down the chain, which you could do with the system actions. And so in 13, obviously once the apps update, they can do that. And so these the workarounds that exist before were like these things where all the apps would kind of copy to the clipboard and they'd convert it as text and you have to get it out of the clipboard. And it was all a massive mess. Now it's really nicely integrated into the same experience. So the same way that you get the parameters for system actions, now expose the same for third-party apps too. And I've been playing around with this with like Daily Dictionary. Before, you could get the word of the day, but you couldn't really do anything with it. You could just show it or, you know, present it as part of your like morning shortcut. Now you can actually get the individual fields like definition or example usage, those like text strings. You can pull those out of the shortcut and then show them however you want, maybe in like an alert with other information. Like, and to the user, now it, as long as the apps are obviously updated to support the new stuff, there's no kind of like two tiers anymore. Like the system actions and the third-party actions all have the same capabilities. And then you layer on top of all of that the automation stuff, which is what they removed. And that would mean the all these shortcuts, which are, you know, really helpful, convenient things that you can set up, now can actually be triggered in response to events. So without the user actually having to activate them manually. So you could do stuff like, you know, when you come home, when you leave, certain times of day and stuff. So all of that kind of built up together actually results into, you know, a shortcut experience is a lot more sophisticated, arguably easy to use, but also more capable. So they've, you know, I think they've done a good job, because last year I was kind of like not mocking them, but it was like a bit pointless. Whereas now I feel like they actually have utility for a lot wider audience.
Yeah, being built in, I've had people in my family who are running the betas because they see it on my stuff and they're like, what is that? I want that, you know. And one of the first things they say upon installation is, oh, what are shortcuts? Because it's a new app on their home screen that, you know, has been there in the apps for the whole time, you know, a workload before that, but it was never in front of them. And now it's built in. And I think it's great timing to push it on more people at the same time of making it way more user-friendly and way more capable, because I could navigate it before, but it was just, there were things that I'd want to do with it that you couldn't do. And you know, assuming automations returns before iOS 13 is released or when it's released, then it will be much more interesting for a lot of people. So I'm looking forward to that too. And I hope it comes back. It sounds like it will. at least we have that. We don't have input on anything else that's been gone, but we do have it from shortcuts.
Yeah, like one of the fun things that I set up during the beta period was an automated shortcut to change the wallpaper, because one of the new actions they added, although I think
it's gone.
Yeah. Was a set wallpaper action. So I had I had like a two-step shortcut, and what it did was it went to the photo library, it went to the photos, it went to favorites, so obviously all the ones you've hearted, and it just picked a random picture, and then it would set that as the wallpaper. And then I used automations to make that shortcut trigger at sunrise and sunset. So basically, you'd get two different images every single day, you know? And obviously, it's not like so simple anyone could do it, but it wasn't complicated, right? It was within the realm of possibility. And that's just something that you could never get even close to achieving in the iOS 12 cycle, whereas now it was actually possible.
Yep.
And it actually worked, and it was really cool.
I hope that comes back, too, in shortcuts, because that's one of the things, like, where they've got those four new wallpapers that are, like, color splashes that change automatically between light and dark mode. And that's cool. And if you have your phone or iPad set to change at sunset and sunrise, then it's basically your wallpaper changes at sunset and sunrise with those four wallpapers in those colors. But if you wanted to use your own wallpaper like you always have before, then it would also be nice to have your wallpaper have like a light mode and dark mode of your own choice. Like even if it's like a photo that is like, you know, a black portrait mode photo and like a light portrait mode photo, like having that be customized, automated with dark mode, light mode goes perfectly together because it's not an option to do that otherwise within iOS.
Yeah, and the automations that they have go beyond like even what you could do before with HomeKit Scenes. So they even have stuff like when you toggle Bluetooth, when you connect to a Wi-Fi network, when you start a workout on your watch, you can make a shortcut run. So say if you have like if you're at home in your, you know, like quote unquote indoor gym, but maybe it's just your office or something, and then you start a workout on your watch, you can make your HomePod start playing music. Mm-hmm. You can make the fan turn on. You know, you can do all sorts of stuff in response, and all you're doing is just tapping, you know, start a workout, indoor workout on your watch. Like, there's so much more flexibility now than there ever was, and you know, I'm hoping all the, you know, random stuff that's currently not there returns, but even without it, it was still a massive leap forward from, you know, what it was last year. Because last year, it was basically taking the workflow app and adding it into the system and kind of making Siri shortcuts work. But now they've had like an extra year to like grind on it. It's a much more holistic system with a lot wider use. Before, it was very like restrained and kind of constricted to certain cases, whereas now it's much more universally applicable. Hiring these days just isn't as simple as putting an ad in the newspaper or posting to a job board. With more qualified candidates than ever before and remote work expanding the hiring pool even further, you need something to help you find the right people for your business. When you're juggling the need for new hires with everything else it takes to grow your business, it's important to be able to reach out to the right candidates at the right time. This is where LinkedIn Jobs comes in. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. Over 600 million members visit LinkedIn to make connections, learn and grow as professionals, and discover new job opportunities. In fact, LinkedIn members add 15 new skills to their profiles and apply to 35 job postings every 2 seconds across the platform. LinkedIn's wide database enables them to put your job post in front of the people with the right academic qualifications and soft skills to meet your role requirements. Education and grades are important, but LinkedIn also considers qualities like collaboration, work ethic, and adaptability. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. To get $50 off your first job post, go to linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get started now with a $50 discount when you make your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, Mayo, I wanted to give you an update on News Plus, and it's like a disclosure, like when you're in stock and investing or something. I'm out of News Plus now. I'm no longer in News Plus. So. You know, I liked it for the reasons we discussed a few weeks ago. But like I said, I had some decisions to make, and it kind of opened up my eyes about just like how I'm approaching subscription services. And it's more than just we have subscription fatigue and overload these days. And it's just like you either want to like cancel as many as you want as you can, you know, or not worry about it. For me, it's more like there are essential subscription services that I just do not consider, you know, cancelable, like a gym membership. I'm not going to cancel that. In terms of like Apple services, it's iCloud storage space. I pay for the 2 terabyte, $10 a month service. And I think it's too high for what I want, but you know, $120 a year for what you get from that. But for me, I'm not going to go back to the old way of managing my photos for one. And so I would pay a standalone fee if it was just for iCloud photos and not like backup storage and all that stuff and sync. But having the ability to take a picture on my iPhone and have it like that picture or video, like 4K video, be on the iMac or the MacBook or the iPad, I can't go back to the old way of syncing like in any other way. And
yeah, and having peace of mind that that picture is actually on a server somewhere, you know, if a disaster happened.
Yes, it's both local and on a server somewhere, so it is backup as well. And all the edits are synced and everything, and it's just so nice. Like, because even like with I used to be a big iPhoto user when that was like the thing before photos, and I would sync manually and I would sync albums and everything. But you know, I would only edit on one thing and not, you know, man. And now you can edit on anything and they all sync and it's so great. And like, even just like deleting pictures on one, they go away everywhere and it's so nice. So that alone is worth it for me. The other one is Apple Music. There's just no way I would cancel Apple Music because I just get so much utility out of it. Even if I'm not getting like, I cannot do the math of like what is purchasing music versus, you know, subscribing to a streaming service, because the fact of the matter is, if I was purchasing albums, I would not listen to the same amount of music. I wouldn't try the same amount of music because I can, when I can stream everything. Like, I can find a new artist and add their discography, and it's just, I cannot do that, you know, with purchasing. I would only buy my favorites and that would be it. So News Plus is not like that, where it's one of those, services that are essential for me, where it's like in this experimental, realm, which is, I think, having a budget every month for the non-essential subscription services is okay, as long as it's, you know, a manageable budget. It isn't like I'm going to try like every subscription and forget about it, you know. And so for me, News Plus, I got the value for a couple of months, and then I felt like I want to try something else that I'm more curious about. And it's not just the money, but it's the time. So I put that $10 to $15 a month from News Plus into the HBO Apple TV channel. And even with that, I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of it, but I think I'm going to be able to get what I want out of it over the next month or two and then move on, because it's not just the money, but it's the time. Like, I've got to, if you subscribe to News Plus, you, to feel good about it, you need to make time to read magazines or newspapers that are included. And if you don't, then you just feel like you're wasting your money. And it's the same way with HBO. There were some new shows that I heard talked about and I wanted a way to watch it, and just, you know, subscribing to the Apple Channels feature, I can also see what is that like on the Apple TV app, on the iPhone and iPad and Mac and Apple TV and the Samsung TV with the TV app. So there's some, you know, experimentation going on there too. And I'm not like now a lifelong HBO Apple TV channel subscriber, but for the next few months, I'm gonna, you know, that's where I will spend my extra entertainment time. And with that being said, like, I found some things about it that I didn't when I was doing the trial for a week, you know, that you don't get much out of that. When there's something you're actually invested in, you know, and a show you want to really, you really get into, I found that I'm a person now who is okay with watching part of a show on the iPhone and part of a show on the iPad, and even turning my iMac into a TV while I'm doing something else, and using the TV on, you know, the Apple TV and the Samsung TV. And I didn't realize that with HBO as an Apple TV channel, you also have the option to stream live on the East channel and the West channel of like what's playing. I thought it was all just on-demand stuff, but it's like what you'd pay if you had HBO or the over-the-top app.
I didn't actually know that. So that those live channels show up inside a TV.
Yeah, they're inside a TV. The only thing is now that I'm experimenting with this more, and there's more Apple TV channels coming. Like CBS All Access came this month, which is terrific for shows that are only on CBS All Access or on CBS anyway. And I'm not sure if they have, I don't think that includes live, but it might. But, one thing I can say is that even when you subscribe to Apple TV channels in the Apple TV app, they don't especially like surface content from that channel. I think it's, you know, you can add things to your up next queue and then that services it well. But my complaint is, would be that by being just an HBO subscriber through Apple TV channels, you still need to go way down in the list to find the channel section to explore basically the HBO app inside of the TV, you know, TV app, which I still prefer to the HBO app. You know, you get downloads, which you won't get through HBO's app and website, and you get a real app on the Mac where you wouldn't get on, just an HBO Now subscription. But they don't like make like a, you know, here's a shortcut to things you actually pay for. They still show you a lot of stuff from things that you don't have, which is not good. And it feels like the TV channel section needs to be like, you know, right below your up next queue. Like these are the things that you're paying for and you like. Instead, it's like below.
Yeah, you need like a two tab approach where it's like, here's all your recommendations and here's recommendations of stuff you can watch and not, you know, that is actually available to you right now.
Yep. And then even within the HBO channels section, you know, Apple TV channel section, like you're in the HBO experience, that's pretty good at like, you know, browsing and finding what's on HBO. But on the phone, at least, I'd say everywhere but the TV on a TV set, they surface weird stuff like videos on how to subscribe to the channel that you already subscribed to and how to find content. And so there's some tutorial stuff that I just would never want to see that you wouldn't see if it wasn't through the channels feature. And then also, like I mentioned, being able to watch live HBO, the East and West broadcast, I stumbled upon that after several days of using the feature because it's literally at the very bottom. It's just like, this is the most bottom. It's not like a recommendation. It's not a category. It's just like, we need a place to put this, so it's on the bottom. And it works, but I think there needs to be like, if this is a successful part of Apple services business, you know, just like every other new service they enter, they need to refine the experience because who knew you could stream live HBO to the TV channels app like that. You know,
but. Yeah, that like what you just said, all of that is like my number one reservation with the success of Apple TV Plus. It's not like the shows they're going to make, it's the way that you access it. And the TV app definitely needs some improvements to be like perfect because it just feels so bad when you're paying for, you know, whether it's Apple TV Plus or HBO or any of this stuff, and then you have to just wade through loads of recommendations of things that, you know, you probably don't want to pay for, and you definitely don't want to, you know, see pushed in your face when you just want to watch the stuff that you paid for. So like all of that experience I hope will improve at some point.
And because it's Apple, you have the expectation at launch that it's either going to be really good or it's going to be rushed and take time to get really good. Like eventually it
News will, Plus.
Yeah, eventually it will become like Apple quality, but you know, if you're just doing the cash grab at first, then you might put it out there before it's fully baked.
And the TV app is better than the News Plus state of affairs.
Totally. Yeah,
it's not. Yeah, but it's higher up the chain, but it's not perfect.
What would be like the TV Plus equivalent of News Plus showing PDF scans? Like, it's just like DVDs. If like you can see this, but you have to have a DVD player or something, or you can only watch.
Or it's 4x3 only.
Yeah, it's standard definition. You can still, like, if you're buying movies and TV shows on iTunes, at least for movies, there's often like a separate release date for standard definition, which is like a few dollars cheaper, but it's so weird that like
it's such an arcane system.
At least standard doesn't come first. HD usually comes first, but and last thing on all this is I hope Apple figures out makes the deals to get 4K Disney content on Apple TV, because isn't it still the case that most of it is, or if not all of it is just HD and not 4K?
And they're taking all their new stuff obviously into their own subscription of Disney Plus, so
that might be the fix, is that they'll stream in 4K, I imagine, and
I mean, it remains to be seen whether Disney Plus becomes part of the TV app, like whether it becomes a channel or whether it even shows up next, because obviously Netflix has opted out.
I would assume it's going to be like Netflix for the foreseeable future until they need to integrate. And
I don't think it's out of the question that it becomes a channel, but I don't think they're going to do it at launch, if you know what
sure
I mean.
Yeah,
they'll try and strike their own ground, and then if it fails, then they'll start doing partnerships and stuff, because Disney Plus is going to be $6.99 to start.
Yeah, it's really
quite cheap.
Or $12.99, we learned this week, will include ESPN Plus and Hulu with ads. Which is just like Netflix price for I think two streams of TV.
And I'm sure the Disney Plus pricing will increase over time, just like Netflix prices increase over time. But, you know, it's an aggressive entry, especially when we expect, like, TV Plus probably to come in at $9.99. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe that'll be the fix for getting 4K, Avengers without having to use like there's all these workarounds where you can buy it from some service that you never use and then view it through like Movies Anywhere, things like that, or through that services app. And I can't be bothered, but because to me the difference isn't worth it. But I feel like eventually they'll say now Disney is 4K and that's what I'm waiting for, and then I've got them all in one place and not this workaround.
Investing in the stock market can be confusing and daunting. Brokers make it super easy to invest in pretty much anything these days, but who knows where to start? If you have spare funds to invest, but are otherwise overwhelmed by the jargon and rigmarole involved, consider using My Wall Street. My Wall Street offers a short list of stock investment ideas recommended by their teams of experienced investors. They are not a broker. You cannot buy stocks through them. They are only an investment advice vehicle. They act as an investing companion, offering shortlists of thoroughly researched stocks that they believe have significant growth potential. And at the end of the day, it's up to you to decide what to invest in based on their independent advice. The My Wall Street app guides you through the whole process from getting started with a broker to building and managing a diversified portfolio. My Wall Street helps you take the first steps in the world of investing and guides you towards making educated decisions across your financial life. They show you how you can invest, what you can, and when you can. Happy Hour listeners can access the entire My Wall Street app for free and give it a try for 30 days, extending beyond the normal 7-day trial period. Visit mywallstreet.com/happyhour to download the app and access stock picks and expert investing guidance. That's spelled mywallst.com/happyhour. After your trial, you can continue your investing journey for $9.99 a month. Check out My Wall Street today at mywallst.com/happyhour. Thanks to My Wall Street for sponsoring the show.
All right, let's talk about the Apple Card launch, because that is a thing that's happened for some people, not just retail employees or corporate employees, but there are actual customers now who can sign up for the Apple Card, and I've seen on Twitter now that the people are already receiving the physical cards. The trick here is that it's invite only, based on people who give their Apple ID email address to Apple through the Apple Card webpage online. But not everyone who's done that has received an invite yet. It seems to be really, a continuous rollout, but not all at once for obvious reasons, stability and testing. I'm not in the invite camp yet, so I don't have much to say here. And you're in the UK, so you can't apply.
And they said it will be out for everyone by the end of the month, right?
I didn't hear that. I guess that's news to me. Well, they did say August.
Widely at the end of the month.
Yeah, Tim Cook said on the earnings call, which we've had so many stories in prepping this. We didn't even think to include the earnings call. Thankfully, we don't have to, because who cares? But yeah, that was one thing mentioned in the earnings call, was Tim Cook says in August. And that was, I guess, at the end of July when he said that. So for everyone, we assume, unless he meant this rollout that's happening now. But for a lot of people, what happens, the default way this is supposed to happen, is that you get an email sent to your email address that you applied for, or requested to be notified at. And then you go to the wallet app and you hit plus and you go from there. But also, people have noticed that when you go to the wallet app and hit plus, if you're about to receive the email, like within a few hours, you'll see it early. And so that's created the behavior that I have, which is to regularly check the wallet app by hitting the plus button for the application option. And I'm on day three now.
You're just
doing
like
that.
Pavlovian, tap, 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 tap.
Yeah, I feel better now, like seeing enough people say, I did this without the email. And then later on they say, oh, I got the email now too. Like it was like hours later. So I feel okay by just like letting it go, and I'll just see it when I see it.
I just checked. The Verge had a embargo PR statement, and in part of that, they said it will be available to everyone at the end of the month.
Terrific. So August is we're 1 week in so far, so three to go. So I don't have anything to say there, but one of our writers, Chance Miller, did, and I don't know what the order is that they're doing this with, but the fact that he got it and I didn't is just still, gets me a little bit. I just want to apply, but I do like some of the details that we've seen since this is, actually started happening, which is, we knew that people in retail could apply And if they weren't eligible, it didn't do a hard credit check. But that seems to apply to everyone based on how they do it, right? Like you see almost like a pre-qualification, you know, pitch to you, what your credit limit would be and your APR, what that would be before you accept the offer. And then once you accept it, then you get the hard credit inquiry like later that evening or so, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the whole kind of thing with the Apple Card and how it like ties into the Apple brand is, it to me, it feels like a no, like gotcha card. There's no like hidden secrets about it, or no like, you know, weird clauses and catches and odd bits. Like it's not the best rewards ever, but it's straightforward and it's upfront, right? And like I feel like it's a credit card where you can describe the entire terms of the system in like a sentence, and very few credit cards you can do that, because even, you know, most of the ones that actually do work out to be better value in terms of rewards and stuff, they have to funnel through like point systems and conversions and, you know, all of that baloney. Like the Apple Card is very like straightforward and simple, and, you know, that's ultimately why, you know, it ties into the Apple brand so well and doesn't feel like out of place. Because you're exactly right, like you can get an invite to the card, and then when you go to add it, it asks for some of your information, and they do like a soft pull check, and they present to you the offer. And a lot of cards will do like pre-qualification offers, but very few of them will actually show you their credit limit up front. Normally, that only comes after you accept, because I think by law, they only have to show your interest rate. So obviously, that means that most of the industry only shows you the interest rate. But the Apple Card, when you apply, it will come up like immediately with your credit limit, your interest rate, and then it will say no fees, just to, you know, double down on the fact that there are no other fees. And all of Apple Card is like really well designed. Like there's a lot of design execution on this entire thing that makes it so simple to like understand and follow along with what's going on, from the setup process to the graphs to everything. I'm really impressed with like the UI stuff in a way that like News Plus completely flopped, but the Apple Card experience is so much better than that. Like, and you can tell they've actually like spent the time to do it. And it is kind of like no downside, but there's no like, oh, if you do this wrong and you go to apply, but then you decide you don't want it, well, now you've got, you know, a hard credit check on your history, and that really sucks. Like, those kind of edge cases just don't really exist with the card. Like, obviously, if you don't pay, they're going to send the debt collectors around eventually. But there's no, like, penalties for being late and stuff. Like, a lot of these cards, you miss a month's payment, you're all right. You miss 2 months' payment, they slap you with a $50 fee, and then they bump your interest rate up by, like, another 10%. So it'd be, like, 29% interest, which is kind of, like, insane. And the Apple Card is, like, 13 to 23.9, something like that. And it doesn't matter if you miss a payment, it will never change. They don't have penalty fees, they don't have penalty interest rates. Like, it's a much more like friendly card in that kind of way. Like, and that's how ultimately it doesn't feel like out of place in the Apple world, if you know what I mean. Like, yes, it's a credit card, but it definitely feels like one that tries not to trick you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and 23.99% APR is not low, but and so far we've seen a range of what people have been sharing about what their credit limit is and what the APR is, the annual. So I think the highest we've seen so far is $20,000, and with around 13% APR. So yeah, we're kind of seeing the range. And we've even seen through Reddit people who have applied and been declined, and show how that looks too. So that's another part of this. And just to recap, the benefits here are that you get 3% on purchases from Apple, in the Apple Store, Apple.com, iTunes, the App Store, including in-app purchases and games and services like Apple Music and iCloud Storage Plan. So that's nice. And then it's 2% on Apple Pay transactions. So when you use NFC, your contactless payments, and then 1% on everything that you use the physical card with, where Apple Pay isn't accepted. And that percent that you get back is later that day in Apple Cash, which is still through Green Dot Bank, right?
Yeah, so far. I the terms and conditions are quite funny. They say Apple Pay Cash is currently with a third-party provider. So yeah. There's probably like a contracts argument going on where Apple agreed to like a Green Dot contract for 5 years or whatever, and now that Goldman Sachs obviously wants to take over eventually, so they're probably sorting. I'm sure at some point that Apple Cash will be taken over by Goldman Sachs as well.
Yeah, and if you don't have the Apple Cash card, what happens?
It just gets refunded on your balance.
Okay. Which is also an option for what you can do with your Apple Cash if you don't want to manage that. And it's not just like at the end of the day. It's like, I guess it's like after each transaction, you see what the amount was. And then you get
They show you instantly what it's going to be, but obviously it doesn't actually go into your account until like the next day when the transaction clears and stuff.
Which is also quite fast for a credit card. For balances not to be the next day and not convert your points and then redeem them whenever, you know, after a billing, you know, period. So
And then on repaying the balance, obviously you get that nice UI with that like wheel, and it will show you very clearly like, this is how much you should pay to pay nothing at all, this is your minimum. But like, they don't try and like force people into paying fees, because it like shines bright red. It's like, please don't do this. But essentially it's like, you should pay this amount, right?
Yeah.
You should pay this amount. And they even let you set up automatic payments, so you can have it automatically deduct from your bank if you want to, like on a schedule.
Yeah. And there's lots of things that people still want from Apple Card that you can't do yet. Like, you can't have a joint account where it's one credit limit balance payment that you share with you and your partner, for example, and you've got two copies of the card. It's one per person. There's no, like when you first sign up, there's no promotional, you know, same as cash financing options for, you know, initial large purchase. So that's a perk that you just don't have. And there's no, balance transfers. Like, if you get approved for $20,000 and you're trying to pay off, you know, $2,000 here with bad APR and $5,000 here, you couldn't transfer that balance to Apple Card. There's no balance transfers yet. So there's no business accounts yet. And also, something that people have noticed since the card is actually out is that if you use those third-party apps that manage, where you can manage your finances by like data exporting, you can't do that with Apple Card. So those are things that maybe they'll listen to people and they'll say, okay, these are things we want to do, but initially we're only launching with these features, just like anything else. And they might come up in the future. Maybe they just never do those.
I think they will add like export options for like Mint and other stuff, because the support document like calls it out. It says exporting to apps like Mint is not currently supported. Like, they wouldn't put it in that kind of language if they didn't have it on their roadmap. And the only option you have at the moment is you can export a PDF of your like account history,
with Apple Cash.
Exactly, just like Apple Cash. And if Apple doesn't come up with an API, those Mint services and stuff are just going to pass the PDFs. Like, they'll have you export, generate, and import the PDFs. Like, that's a foregone conclusion that'll happen. But probably next year they'll do like an API, and you know, they'll make it secure and on device, because that's the other thing. Obviously, they say their contract with Goldman Sachs says that Goldman Sachs cannot use your data for anything other than operating the card, so like fraud and stuff like that, but they're not allowed to sell it for marketing or advertising or targeting. And Apple doesn't see your transactions at all, because it's only stored on device. So again, they push the privacy angle, and I'm sure that contributes into why right now there's no export to Mint and stuff like that. But down the road, that stuff will be filled out.
Yeah,
the stuff of joint accounts and, you know, people sharing the same card, that might be something where they're just, the way that they run their numbers and their policies, they're never going to support that kind of thing. But stuff like API access will come, I'm pretty sure.
But it seems like an easier challenge to anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, you do get some perks through Discover too, because it's Goldman as the issuing bank and it's Discover as the card.
It's MasterCard.
So you do get some perks from MasterCard as well that you get with any other MasterCard credit card. So that's nice. But you know, Chance, again, back to him, who has one with us now, is he's been making purchases, and he's pretty, you know, he pays attention to what is the perk with this card versus that. At this store, which should I use that gives me the best benefit? And so he's had a few occasions where he wants to use the Apple Card, but he's like, oh no, wait, this is at this place, I get this percent back and it's better than Apple Card. You know, or this place you get, more warranty on a purchase. So it's competition, and at launch, Apple can have its set of, you know, values and goals for people that makes it work well. But surely, you know, if they look at the numbers and they feel like they're starting to peak out and they're not seeing growth, then maybe they'll, you know, the competition will make them even more competitive with all the safeguards for consumers and everything. And the way that you pay, the UI and everything, it looks terrific. For me, I do all my purchases through the web on my Mac, or all my bill payments on the web through the Mac, if it's not on automatic payment. So this would be different, where it's something I can only manage either automatically or through the iPhone, not through the web on the Mac. So, just one more thing for the roadmap. Bring that UI to the web. And you can see your balance, I think, on appleid.apple.com, but I don't think that extends to, like, you know, payment management. Although I don't have one yet, so I can't tell you.
Ideally they'd have a Mac app for
right. And or an iPad app, and there's something to that in a moment. But also this week we've seen that the classic Barclay Apple Rewards card is starting to wind down and kind of uncuff itself from Apple. So what's happening there?
Yeah, so for a while, Apple has partnered with Barclays to offer kind of like the pre-Apple Card Apple Card, in that it did actually say Apple Rewards on the card, like the printed, the actual physical card. Obviously, it wasn't integrated into the iPhone or anything like that. It was mostly just a Barclays card that gave you some points that you could convert into like App Store vouchers, essentially, or iTunes vouchers. As well as triple points and some other rubbish. But as part of, now that obviously they're pallying up with Goldman Sachs, the Barclays card has, the rewards card has gone away. For the time being, you can still buy through the Apple Store Barclays 0% financing options. So you can, you know, like buy a Mac and have it for a year and pay month by month and not have interest.
Right.
Just like the Apple Cash situation, I bet that at some point Goldman Sachs is going to take that over as well. Because if you think back to a Wall Street Journal report from February that was talking about the upcoming Goldman Sachs partnership, the whole preamble of that was about Apple exploring ways to consolidate all their banking partnerships.
Sure, yeah.
Because like in the UK, they have Barclays and some other people. They obviously have Green Dot for cash. They have Barclays over here. They have Citizens One for the iPhone upgrade program. Like at the moment, they have so many different partnerships with all these different like banking and insurance institutions. And I'm pretty sure the Goldman Sachs deal that was signed extended to more than just the credit card. And I bet soon you'll start seeing, oh, now if you want 0% financing on your MacBook, you have to buy on the Apple Card, for instance. Or the iPhone upgrade program coming next month for the iPhone 11, I bet that's Apple Card orientated rather than being, oh, you go through Citizens One, it's be like, you know, you buy it with your Apple Card and you can pay month by month and you have no interest and you get Apple Care included and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, this partnership's going to infect or spread out to everything eventually. I think at the moment they're just kind of like letting the contracts run dry. Mm-hmm. On their existing deals.
Yeah, and that would feed into what people want, which is, you know, financing options for purchases and warranty extensions that you could get from other cards. So then you'll have less of those times where you say, I want to use the Apple card, but there's a better perk from another card. Let's also discuss a Ming-Chi Kuo story, which is unlike many others that are based on the supply chain and is more on what patents, but it's about the return of Touch ID on an iPhone with Face ID. What's the story there?
Yeah, there wasn't like a hard supply chain link here. This is one of Kuo's, like I'd say a few times a year, Kuo comes out with these reports that are like him just not spitballing, but his like premonitions rather than, you know, I've heard that this supplier is doing this and producing this for this quarter.
Yeah, it's like more like what every other analyst does, but with a little bit more.
Yeah. They're definitely the ones that you know, you don't dismiss them because at the end of the day it is Kuo, but they're not like the ones that you like bind to, right? It's almost like a separate category. But, and this was definitely in that camp because it was kind of talking about Apple's continued interest in Touch ID and under the screen Touch ID specifically with patents, and apparently some vague chats with Qualcomm, and Qualcomm has the ultrasonic technology for underscreen fingerprint scanners. And Kuo essentially laid out like a roadmap that there are still existing issues today in terms of like size of the module, battery life, area of the sensing, like so where, how much of the screen you can actually put your finger on for it to recognize and scan. But he says that those issues will be resolved over the next 18 to 24 months and believes that Apple will in 2021 come out with an iPhone that has both Face ID and Touch ID, essentially giving you the best of both worlds in terms of like authentication options. He said obviously they could market it as a like double security mode where you have to do both, you know, you have to do both forms of biometrics to get in.
Convenient.
I think more likely it just becomes a, oh, you register both and then whichever one unlocks first gets you in. Like, it's a convenience thing, because there are situations where Face ID is not great, there are situations where Touch ID is not great, and if you can buy them together, then the intersection is a lot smaller of like the niggles and the inconveniences and the downsides. So I don't think this is anything like shocking, and obviously it'd be better if it was tied to, you know, an actual supply chain revelation.
But I
think Apple could perfectly bring back Touch ID as an under the screen display technology, and it would fit in with their marketing line without a hitch, because they even don't even call it Touch ID if they didn't want to. They could just call it like under screen fingerprint or something else if they really wanted to, because at the moment they're running those ads which is like Face ID is better than Touch ID because it's faster or whatever, right? But you know, this is 2019. By 2021, the Touch ID thing can be branded as, I don't know, Touch ID 2 or something, or Touch ID Plus, right? Because it'll be under the screen and it'll look different. It won't require a home button. And it'll be 2 years on from these ads anyway. They can change their marketing all over the all over the place. Like, they're not bound to what they're saying today. Obviously, what they're saying today is to promote the current phones that they have in light of the competition, and also to convince people that are still on home button phones to upgrade and maybe are worried about it and stuff. But for me, it's not out of the question in the slightest that Apple could eventually bring back a fingerprint sensing under the screen technology into the phones and, you know, basically make up for the facial recognition downsides and vice versa.
Yeah, a couple of things there. So I would like both to have the option, because there are benefits to each one. I could also see employers that issue, you know, they always limit like phones to their employees, like when they're distributed to employees and what they can access and do. And you could totally see using both as like mandatory on your work phone. But like personally, you wouldn't want to have that, because then you lose that benefit. The other thing is with marketing, when they were developing larger screen iPhones, they were also running ads. They were like, this is an iPhone. Notice that you can reach it here and here with your thumb one-handed. Coincidence? No. And they're also like behind the scenes working on larger screen iPhones. So they'll totally do that, because marketing doesn't, you know, make development of future products. I'm all for this. I hope it happens. It's not like you said, it's not a typical Ming-Chi Kuo rumor, but maybe it will. The only thing is, so they also said, like, you know, they gave like a number of how much more secure Face ID was than Touch ID. And so by using Touch ID, it would lower that number if that was something you were really concerned about. But does doing both add to it? Like, if you say, you know, whatever number plus this number, is that in combination more secure, or would Touch ID lower the security overall if you had to use both?
Well, if you had to use both to unlock, then obviously it would increase security.
Okay.
But
yeah,
that they're not going to do that, because what would be the point?
Yeah.
Like, because obviously if it's then one or the other, then it would be, I think the numbers are 50,000 for Touch ID and a million for Face ID.
Yeah, big gap.
50,000 to one. Sure, but 50,000, everyone was happy with every normal person was happy with the security of Touch ID, really.
Before, yes.
You know,
yeah.
Nothing went wrong. You know, nothing, nobody, no
more of a selling point.
Yeah, exactly. It was more of a way to pump people up. And there's a big asterisk on the million to one, which is that people that look like you, like siblings, reduce that number a lot.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think the number even goes below the 50,000 to one, because you see quite often stories of, oh, my identical sister could unlock my phone as well as me. It's like, you know, that stuff didn't happen with Touch ID. And so those kind of asterisks can be resolved if you have options. Like, if you are an identical twin, the status quo today is, oh, well, use a PIN code. Like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Whereas in 2021, it could be, okay, you can't use Face ID, just use Touch ID only. Or similarly, there are people that have medical conditions like psoriasis, which is like a skin condition, mm-hmm. and that makes Touch ID not work. So in the 2021 world, oh, your Touch ID doesn't work, you can only use Face ID. And then for the, you know, the average case, which is that people that can actually use both, they can just use both, and then the phone responds to whichever one unlocks first and carries on and makes it faster. So if your finger's on the screen, it can unlock with that. If you're looking at the screen, it can unlock with that. And there's basically, you know, no downside, assuming the issues of like battery life and sensing area and thickness and all of those problems that Quo mentions are resolved. At that point, it's like, yeah, why not? It's just going to be seamless and integrated, and just better.
Yeah, an end phone by underscreen fingerprint unlocking, you know, when it was first brought up, it was more like maybe this will work in the future. And now we've seen this in the real world as distributed technology that you can use. So it's not just sci-fi. It's something that could exist. Yeah, you know, I've unlocked Ed Sheeran's phone with my face. He doesn't have a phone. He only uses an iPad. That's from my understanding.
Maybe he's got an iPad Pro.
I don't think so. He needs an upgrade.
Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Text Expander is an incredible Mac productivity tool to have in your arsenal. You can turn the things you type into reusable snippets and access them time and time again. Is there someone's name you have to write down regularly but can never remember how to spell it? Set up an acronym as a text shortcut in Text Expander and never make the same mistake again. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. With variables and forms, snippets are much more powerful. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to edit only the bits that need to be customized for each individual. Text Expander is applicable to so many situations: email addresses, signatures, chunks of code, form letters, even images, anywhere that you need consistent and accurate text. If you have ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. For example, if you're a developer who has to do live presentations, you can use Text Expander to store bits of code. Avoid embarrassing mistakes by letting Text Expander insert the code snippets into your IDE as you concentrate on the core message of your presentation. On the basic plan, Text Expander snippets syncs across all your personal devices, keeping you productive at home or on the road. Text Expander is available for Mac, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. Text Expander for Teams adds a whole extra layer for coordinating work with others. Snippets can be shared automatically across the organization, and you can even see stats about which snippets are being used more than others, so you can focus on tuning up any areas that are being ignored. Companies use Text Expander for Teams for customer support, reporting, and much more. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year's subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
All right, let's also talk about, you know, this story that has unwound and developed in our absence, which is, to me, it felt old, but there was some new stuff here this time. I think it began with The Guardian reporting that some Siri contractors or some Apple contractors could listen to Siri recordings that they were grading, and that they would sometimes, like, the thing that made this catchy was that they could sometimes hear, you know, drug deals and things that you wouldn't want to be heard. And so that was the story that The Guardian had. And I felt like, you know, this is something that we knew about and that was just coming back again. But this time it actually did lead to some changes about how this all works. So what's happening there?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. This was not unknown. And if you actually looked into, like, the Apple security documents and the white papers, it would tell you, you know, relatively explicitly that serial recordings are retained, they're anonymized, but they're sent off for evaluation. And even in, like, do you remember there was a big scandal with the Amazon thing earlier in the year? Supposedly, like, Amazon was listening to recordings and they were getting leaked out, and that was a Bloomberg story. And even in that report, there was a paragraph on how Google uses the exact same stuff for grading Google Assistant, and how Apple does exactly the same thing with Siri. So it wasn't like a, oh, wow, where's this come from? This is brand new information. It just brought to light something that already happened and caught on with the public, like, zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Now, there are definitely things that Apple have done wrong here. Not necessarily done wrong right now, but have done wrong since Siri began or whenever they started doing this grading process. Because the fact that it was news to people means that they weren't clear enough about it.
Sure.
I think that's completely true. When you sign up for Siri, you get that Siri and privacy screen. But if you actually look at that privacy screen today, it does not have anything that explicitly says humans will listen to your recording sometimes. Right? It doesn't just have no allusion to that whatsoever. The information that's on the security white paper, which says, oh, your recording is kept for 6 months with identifying information and up to 2 years anonymized, that information is not on your phone's data and privacy screens. That's only if you go and find the PDF on the website.
Right.
So, like, those issues were, number one, like, you're the company promoting privacy at every step. When there are cases that you need to collect data, you should be transparent about it. And you should be more transparent than anyone else. And people knew that Amazon did it because Amazon let you go onto their website and listen back to your own recordings.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the like both Google and Amazon, you can go on there, you can log into the Alexa portal and you can listen back to the things that it's recorded.
They're the most identifiable.
Yeah. And Siri kind of obscured that because there is no place where you can go and hear what's stored on the server associated to you. So that was problem number one. And that you should definitely, when you set up Siri for the first time, have something that makes it very clear what happens to your recordings. Secondly, unlike basically every other Apple service that asks for data collection, Siri was all or nothing. Like, Apple Maps has modes which is called Improve Maps, which lets you share additional location information and travels and businesses and places you go with Apple to help them make the service better. But Improve Maps can be turned off, and it can be turned on, and I believe it's off by default. The same thing with stuff like Improve Health Tracking or the Watch Workout Modes. All of that stuff can be opted into or enhanced by your feedback. It's off by default. You're asked, do you want to use it? You can turn it on or off. Siri had no opt-out for the data retention part. The page literally said, if you don't want your data to be collected, turn Siri off. But that's ridiculous. Like, this is, you know, the privacy first company. This is the Apple brand. And here's a massive feature that spans all of their platforms and all of their hardware. And the data collection associated with it had no separate option for, do you actually want to, you know, submit your data for review? And had no way to see which had been sent and which hadn't been. And obviously, you know, there are millions and millions and millions of Siri requests a day. Only a very, very, very small fraction of them ever get listened to by a person. Because, you know, even if you had 200 staff working on this constantly, you'd still only be able to process, you know, 5,000 queries a day, and there are like 10 million a day at least. Mm-hmm. So the chances are none of your personal Siri recordings have ever been heard by anybody. And even if they have been, the chances are it was something about completely innocuous and didn't really matter. But obviously in the aggregate, you hear these stories of drug deals and, you know, all of that rigmarole in the aggregate. And yes, it is wrong that they do not have options for opting in and opting out, and they didn't make it clear. And obviously, since we recorded, Apple has actually responded to the brouhaha, and they have said that they have stopped and halted the Siri grading regime. So all these contractors are probably currently out of work, unfortunately. Whilst they review the security policies around Siri and what they're going to do in the future. And they promised that when Siri grading returns, they will offer a explicit opt-in, opt-out option for whether your audio recordings can be saved as part of a future software update. So again, I think their response was pretty good. As long as they do make it clearer and as long as the actual software edit comes out, you know, thumbs up, they've addressed it. The problem is, you know, this has clearly been something that's been in place since, you know, like 2012, and it's just never been looked back on and reconsidered.
Yeah, I guess one question for me is, why do they need contractors for this? It seems like that's one of the most intimate things that Apple has to deal with. And so why do they need to outsource this to, I guess, people that do this sort of work, maybe? I mean, we don't know much about the contractors, but that sounds like external to Apple. So people that aren't on the line with Apple standards as much as an employee might be, like this, even though it's a contract with Apple's rules in place, it's not permanent as a job might be, or maybe you don't get the same benefits. The perks of it aren't as great. So why do you think they need contractors and not just Apple staff that's always there employed to do this kind of thing?
Probably because they have to hire a lot of people to do it, and they want to do it cheaply.
Money, so, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, money. I mean, all the Apple Maps reviews are all done by contractors. The App Store review is not by done contractors, interestingly. That's done by, you know, full-time employees inside of Apple in California. And it would definitely be nicer if the party line was, you know, Apple employees, full-time Apple employees are the ones reviewing this stuff. But then I think they'd be hiring a lot more people to do a job that is essentially menial labor. Like, you know, you're listening to an audio recording and you're ticking a box to say, yes, Siri understood this properly, or no, Siri didn't. Like, So you're always going to be paying them less anyway. So at that point, it's like, well, we'll just give it to contractors to do.
Yeah, they've got a retail team that doesn't get paid terrifically either. So they could do it.
Definitely slightly sweeter story if it was not contractors and just normal people. But the underlying problem would still be the same.
Yeah, that's true. That was just the one thing that stood out to me in the story that felt like the most gross is not like what they hear, because you're going to hear what happens in the world when you hear recordings of the world, but it's that there's contractors and not Apple, and that just feels like it's riskier than if it were Apple employees, which it's hard to even pinpoint why, but it stood out to me. Yeah, so in this case, Apple listened, and after Apple's response to this, a number of other companies that do the same thing promised or, you know, waded in the waters of doing the same thing, where they get, you know, they don't give you an option, they will in the future, and that they'll pause their program now. So we saw even similar from other companies. So
Amazon's gonna let you opt in or opt out, and Google has halted their recordings in Europe because of a legal issue. There is some debate over whether that the practice violates GDPR. So to avoid a lawsuit, Google's paused it, which may have been part of the reason that Apple has paused it as well, just so they don't want to be, you know,
they didn't
on that
get
same
forced,
lawsuit.
Right? Yeah.
So there's a few like conflicting factors here, and I'm sure as part of the Siri security review, they will be double checking with lawyers about what, you know, GDPR allows them to do and what it doesn't.
Yeah. Okay. And there is news on Apple's, speaking of security and everything, there's news on Apple's bug bounty program that was rumored and then today officially announced. So this can be a little bit boring, but what's the interesting things that happened this week in Apple's Black Hat announcement?
Yeah. So Black Hat's like the big hacking their security conference of the year. Apple generally attends and does a presentation. Sometimes they announce some stuff. This is where they announced the original bug bounty program back in like 2016, 2017. This year, they've basically upped the payouts, so it's more attractive to go to Apple rather than go to the black market. But most importantly, they have added all of their platforms into the mix. So that predominantly means macOS now actually has a bug bounty program, which is something we've been talking about for many episodes, because why do they not have one? And obviously, do you remember in like February, there was that big exploit with the keychain, and the guy refused to tell Apple what to do. It as kind of a protest.
Eventually, he did, but
eventually he did. But you know, it was just stupid. Like, why do they not have a bug bounty for a Mac? I'm sure internally to Apple, they thought it was stupid as well. They just never got around to doing the admin for it. And so here it is. Now you can actually get paid for research. For security researchers can get paid for Mac bugs, watch bugs, TV bugs, any platform, iCloud as well. It's all part of one thing now. So there's no like random distinction where, oh, this doesn't affect the iPhone, you can't get any money for it. So, you know, great, fantastic. And they're paying more now. Like an iCloud exploit for getting iCloud data now pays $500,000 versus $250,000 and stuff like that. So
there's even $1 million payout if you can, you know, I think take someone's data without them requiring them to tap or click something, and you can continually do that. So they're prioritizing what you find with how much they pay.
Yeah, exactly. So more incentive to actually, you know, do the right thing and go to Apple versus selling it to a Chinese company and they still pay more, but it's closer, you know, it's bringing it more in line.
And is it also correct that it's going from invite only to anyone?
Yeah, this was kind of a weird thing where like they kind of relaxed the invite only part of the thing informally. So if you weren't in the program but you had a nice bug, you'd probably still get paid anyway. That's kind of been going for like a year, but now they've like formalized it and got rid of the stupid invite only.
Okay, yeah.
So if you have a good bug, you can get paid for it. Yeah. So that's good.
If you're playing Fortnite and you find that group FaceTime is insecure and you're a kid, you can get your college paid for it without being news.
Yeah, that's such a stupid thing. Yeah, and then in addition to the bug bounty changes, they've also announced plans for next year, a program which will allow security researchers in good standing, so kind of an invite-only program, to actually get special devices. And essentially, these, like iPhones and iPads, would be unlocked to allow security researchers to be able to do more investigations into potential exploits on everyone's phones, but using like debug devices that are that don't have the same kind of security restrictions at the top level. Because very often it's incredibly helpful to be able to get access to like shells and terminals and root access to be able to find bugs that exist on everybody's phones, but without this, you know, like provisioned access would be a lot harder to find. So essentially, Apple's going to distribute these devices, which are meant for security research only, to allow people to be able to do more investigations and more testing to find issues that they couldn't find before because the platform was too locked down in other ways.
Yeah, and this is the news that leaked, and Forbes had the report, I believe, which is kind of funny that this is something that leaked, but it seems to be, their description was like pre-jailbroken devices. Is that accurate, or is that kind of a funny way of putting it?
It's roughly close enough.
Okay.
It's kind of.
Yeah.
If you're just looking for a higher level, like, way to describe it, it's not terrible.
Okay. You know what I mean. Okay. And because these are exploiters in good standing, then if the device goes missing, then so does that person, as far as Apple's concerned.
There was actually like a kind of, again, a black market of, because obviously Apple has these devices inside the company, right? Because that's how they make their phones, right? That's how they develop the software. That's how they develop their own internal security testing.
Yeah.
The whole point now is they're bringing it to the outside. But up to now, there's been like this black market of people selling those devices on. So it's all this, it's basically all the stupid like bureaucracy of like everyone was doing this, but having to pay for it through China or through some random company that was really shady. You know, Apple's finally getting to the point where it's like, you know, you can just buy it from us or we'll lend it to you for free. And, you know, it's just doing the obvious stuff that they should have always been doing, but they just never got around to. But it's nice to see them finally doing it.
Yeah, coming soon. Let's end this week on a roundup of some new accessories in the Apple world, which we don't do very often, but there's just enough news this week to make it interesting. We saw a few months ago where the 4K LG ultrafine display went from 21.5 inches to what, 23 inches?
Yeah.
And had some resolution changes there. Then the 5K.
Yeah, the resolution got worse.
Yeah. Then the 5K display was very limited, where you couldn't buy it online anymore. It was only in Apple stores, which it was never in stores before after it had the Wi-Fi issue. Then it disappeared, and now there's a new 5K ultrafine. So you are on this journey of tracking all the differences of the old one and the new one and the changes in between, and even that evolved over time. So what's the quick synopsis there? What's happened?
Yeah, it was, you wouldn't believe it was that difficult for Apple to tell you what was new about a new display. But essentially, there's a new LG 5K display. It's very similar to the previous 5K display, except that it now outputs over USB-C in addition to Thunderbolt 3, which means that you can connect an iPad Pro to it, but there's the gotcha that it doesn't actually output. The iPad Pro does not drive it at 5K. So okay. It only drives it at 4K. So basically, you're no different to plugging into a 4K display.
It's just bigger.
Yeah. And that's basically the only change.
Okay. Yeah.
It's at least back on sale in wide availability.
Yeah. And then the back and forth was, there is some confusion on the documentation side about what you can do with a Mac and how many will run. And
yeah, for a while, there was some downsides, but those turned out to be just like errors in the copy.
Yeah,
so,
and they've been
if you're corrected. A Mac user, it's the same as before.
Yeah. So now you're,
and it's still the same old 5K display that nobody wants to use really, but there's no other choices, so you buy it, and everyone just kind of hopes that maybe Apple will do an external display that isn't $6,000 that's also very nice.
Yeah,
so we're still on the status quo.
Yeah, I think if you want that, this is bad news, because the better scenario would be Apple or LG doesn't do this, and then the old one goes away, and then Apple has like a gap there, and then they fill it themselves. And this just suggests that, like, you know, they could do an Apple display any time, but this also suggests that their plan this month isn't to do that. So and we have an update on AirPower. Apple stores in Europe and coming soon to the US are now carrying a Mophi 2-in-1 and 3-in-1 wireless charger, which is the first time Apple's selling a wireless charger that can charge more than one device on the same pad since the AirPower, their multi-wireless charger, was supposed to be the thing. This still isn't that, because that doesn't exist anywhere. This is more like Mophie's version of what Nomad has been selling for a while, but has still been back ordered. And so the 2-in-1 thing is like, you can put your iPhone and your AirPods on the same mat for $100. It's a 2-in-1 wireless Qi charger. And then you can connect an Apple Watch cable to the back of it or any other cable and charge another device with a wire. And then there's a 3-in-1, which has like a little slot for AirPods, where it's like a little indention that AirPods sit in. And then behind that is the watch puck built in. And then beside that is a spot for your iPhone. That one is $150, I believe. And it's the more elegant solution. And they both have 7.5 watt charging for iPhones. And we haven't decided between us if 7.5 watt is only Mophie and Belkin still, or if it's changed to 7.5 watt for every company. Because for a while it was 5 watt only, and then it was 5 watt for everyone except Mophie and Belkin could do 7.5 watt wireless charging. But at the end of the day, that's not a big difference, and it's still slower than, like, you know, a fast cable with like 18 watt charging over USB Lightning.
Yeah, they're very similar to what Nomad and plenty of other companies sell on Amazon, really.
Yeah.
These are the first ones at the Apple store.
Yeah, and presumably they'll I guess Mophie can ship out faster than Nomad, because Nomad's still back ordered from a few months ago. And Mophie, I guess they'll have more muscle to ship these things. There's also a new AirPods pouch that Apple started selling, and it's from Encase, and I've already seen some people purchase this and use it. And like, AirPod cases are interesting because, you know, it's a case for a case, for one, but often the utility there is, like, it's got a clip on it or something that makes it identifiable and more protected and no scratches. But since the wireless charging has been a thing, you know, you've got to make sure that you can do that, which most I've seen can, but you don't get the indicator light, you know, access if, unless you like fold it over. And, in this case, the new Encase, AirPods pouch, it's like a material that's like fabric, but it's without making a hole, you can see the light through the fabric, which is clever. So I thought that was a neat thing to do.
It's like the old MacBooks with the power light that it was just shining through the metal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In this case, it just shines through the fabric without having a big gap there. And then also today, as we record, Sonos announced that they're going to have a 2-day press event that's not open to the public or not streamed live or anything like that. They had events in the past where the news you can report as it happens. In this case, the news will be under embargo for a few weeks, but they've got an event at the end of August on the 26th and 27th in New York City, and then one closer to the mid-September timeframe in Berlin. And they haven't said what they're going to announce, but they've spoken before about a partnership with a company that will help them do outdoor speakers. They just shipped their AirPlay 2 bookshelf and lamp speakers with IKEA. And then they've also talked about headphones. So I'm curious, the invitation is like a person sitting in a chair looking outside. So I'm not sure what that means. Some news from Sonos later this month or next month we'll have. And then finally, tell me about your experience with Homebridge and your HomeKit fan controlled by an IR blaster.
Yeah, this is just fun. Like, it was getting really, really hot in my office, and I've been holding out for an actual, you know, sanctioned HomeKit fan, because fans do exist as a category, and I was looking for like a desk fan or a, you know, standing tower fan with HomeKit integrated into it, but you know, it's been several years and it just hasn't happened. So I was like, fine, I just need to get one.
Yeah, it's
so,
like ceiling fans only.
Yeah. So then I was thinking, well, what can I make up for somehow? So my first idea was, oh, I can just get a smart plug and just have it turn on and off with that. Like, you can't change the speed or anything, but you can just have it turn on and off with the voice. The problem is most tower fans are kind of intelligent in that when you turn them on and off, they like have a memory of their settings, and just turning them off at the plug does not make the fan start. Like, mm-hmm. You have to turn it on at the plug and then press like a power button to turn it on.
Yeah, so I think like
a
Dyson's
basic smart plug does not work.
Yeah, I think like Dyson's expensive but really impressive fan, like bladeless fans like this, where it's on and then it's like similar to a TV where then you need to use a remote to control it.
Yeah. So what I found on Amazon was a Honeywell standing fan. It was only about £50. I think it was on discount. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. But what it was, you can control it with a remote. So it comes with an infrared remote. And obviously, I don't want to use a remote. But because it's got infrared compatibility, there's a IR blaster that can be linked up to Homebridge. And it's called the Broadlink RM. So if you want to Google it, you want to buy one, it's called Broadlink RM. You bring it home. You connect it to your Wi-Fi. You connect the Wi-Fi to the something you're running Homebridge on. I have a Synology NAS. I just run it on there. You configure it up. You have to like point the fan remote at the blaster for it to learn the codes. So like, you have to like go, you know, code one is this, code two is that, code three is that. But then, and then you have to feed all those codes into a plugin for Homebridge, which is a Broadlink plugin, but it's made by a third party. So it's like hack built on hack built on hack. But at the end of the day, you can expose a fan to HomeKit that has all the natural controls, but is on the back end actually operated by infrared flying across the room. Yeah. It works really well. Unfortunately, there is a slight gotcha, because theoretically the fan plugin could support all of the different services that a normal fan would, whether that's speed, oscillation, power, all of that stuff. But the fan that I bought for speed options, it doesn't have like a separate button for like slow, medium, fast. It's one button which toggles between them. And unfortunately, that is the same infrared signal getting sent out every single time on the remote.
Yeah.
So obviously, there's no way for the blaster to be able to say, set it to high, set it to low. So what I've actually done, the oscillation worked. That was a, you know, native control in HomeKit.
Okay.
But the fan speed would not work. So what I've actually just done is exposed it to HomeKit as a switch. And then, you know, you can obviously with a switch, you can say display as fan.
Yeah.
So I just have on and off on IR at the moment, and that works great.
I've used a fan with a smart plug, and you can, you know, in HomeKit, without using Homebridge, you can say this smart plug is a thing. It is not just a plug and outlet. It's also it's specifically a lamp, on and off a light, or a fan. And then, you don't get fan speed, but you get on and off. And I've used one from Vornado that had a physical switch on the back of it with different fan speeds. And so what you could do was leave that switch in the on position because there's no remote involved. And then you pick the fan speed 1, 2, or 3, and you just, you know, you get HomeKit Siri control of on and off at that speed. I've never tried with Homebridge, and to try and get like even like oscillation control is pretty cool. And that's interesting. Like HomeKit supports oscillation, but there's no fan that does, because like a ceiling fan wouldn't. It's just speed and direction.
Yeah.
And it's too bad.
Yeah, there is supposedly a Chinese fan that's sold in China that does do this stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually did consider looking at importing it.
Right.
But it was ridiculously expensive, and then you'd pay import costs. So I was like, I can't, you know.
Yeah.
Can someone in you know, the Western world please release a proper HomeKit standing fan? Because I think it'd be really nice.
I should talk to the people, the Vocalink people, because they tend to fill in categories that are empty, like the human, like the the humidifier thing.
So
that's the flower bud.
But this was quite a fun project. I did it in one morning on Sunday.
Right. Yeah.
I thought it was going to be more painful than it turned out to be. It turned out to be pretty relatively painless, with not very much configuration or annoying edge cases. There's quite a lot of good documentation for the Homebridge extension. So if you're looking for like a fun hack to do, it was quite a cool little project to fill out. And you know, I was a bit concerned that maybe infrared would be unreliable or something, but it seems to work perfectly, so I've been very happy.
So you've got a physical remote in your office that's got to be there aiming, right?
No,
not anymore. What is it? It's just got to be in the room.
The infrared blaster has to be aiming at the fan.
Okay.
So because basically the infrared blaster pretends that it's the remote and sends the codes back at the fan.
Oh, so what does that look like, and like how big and small, and where's it located?
Okay, it's about the size of an Apple TV.
Okay.
So it's quite small, right?
Yeah.
And I just leave that. You can hang it on the wall. You can like put it in your desk. I just have it on a corner of my desk. And so, and because it's a bigger sensor size than a remote would be, so you don't have to be like super precise with it, obviously, because it basically just spurts infrared in like a massive cone.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be like super exact with it. And so the way it works is you basically, the infrared blaster learns the same signals that a remote would give out. So you, the first time you set it up, you like point the remote at the blaster and go power.
Gotcha.
And then you press the power button on the remote. It sees the signal on the other end. It remembers that signal. And then you associate that to be on and off with the switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So the remote, the remote can continue to be used, like the handheld remote for the fan. If I want to, I can continue to use that, or you can just leave it in a drawer and just use Siri on my HomePods or on the Home app. And all of those same IR commands just blast out of the blaster instead.
Yeah, if I had one of the fancy bladeless Dyson fans, then I would have to do this to make it work. And Homebridge is like, you can use it on always on Mac, like a Mac Mini or an iMac that you don't turn off. But Synology, it's so awesome on Synology because, you know, it's a server in your home. It's just a little box that you, you know, have connected to the internet. And the installation process, I've never done it on a Mac before, but on Synology, it's really easy to configure. There's even like a special UI for it that someone's made that makes managing it really easy. And so the only thing I've done with Synology so far, because I've got so much HomeKit stuff that's like, you don't have to hack around it. But my TV is not HomeKit because it's like a 2017 OLED from LG, not like 2019 or 2018. So, that I've enjoyed having HomeKit support through Synology, through Homebridge. Last thing I'll say is, you know, I've also acquired a fan this summer, and it's one that works with just a HomeKit switch for on and off. But what I found interesting about this one is like $70. It's from a company called Cool Flow, and that's cool with an KOOL-FLO, 16-inch, 3-speed indoor stand fan. I just like the way it looked, like it was like, you know, metal and not plasticky, so it would be okay on the eyes. It has 3 speeds, but what's very rare on fans is that when you go from off to the next to on, usually you go 0, 3, 2, 1, like off, fastest, medium, slowest. And there's some reason for that, I guess, circuitry or whatever, but this fan doesn't advertise this as a feature, but it goes off, slow, medium, fast, which I think is just terrific. Huh. It's you know, if that bothers you on other fans, you're like, I just want to go the slowest, like I skip the middle two to go to like the slowest speed. Then this fan doesn't do that. It goes off, slow, medium, fast, which is just really nice. But it's not a HomeKit fan or anything. So,
yeah. And this I blast away, it was only like $30. So it's pretty damn cheap.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, that is the Happy Hour Podcast for the week. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe if you don't already. Rate the podcast in Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave a review if you really enjoy it. We love the feedback and reading that. Or if you listen in Overcast, give us a star and that will help more people discover the show. If you have any feedback for us, you can email us directly at happyhour@9to5mac.com. Also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're at
BZA Mayo.
And if you have any questions for us that you want us to discuss on the show, we enjoyed doing our hashtag Ask9to5Mac episode last week using questions sent through Twitter. Just using that hashtag shows us that there's a tweet with a question on it. You don't have to mention it unless it's something specific for us. Much easier to keep up with that way. And please send more because we will continue to do that segment every now and then. Not every week, but when we see some good questions that we think we want to discuss together, we will. Also, I released a new episode of Watch Time last week with Alex Cox from Cards Against Humanity. So check that out if you haven't already. I really appreciate all the feedback from that episode because it was a heavy episode, but it was fun to record and I was nervous to release it, but just the feedback that I've received so far, I'm really grateful for. And check out the Apple Watchcast podcast, this week I got to be a guest on that and, discuss kind of the behind the scenes of Watch Time and my love of Apple Watch and health and fitness and some 9to5Mac stuff. So give that a listen. It's about an hour long discussion that we had on Monday evening this week. I think that's everything for the week. We will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.